everyone. Welcome to the Unlawful Void edition of Romaniacs. I'm Dorian Linsky. This is the show that never sleeps. We've had two live shows and an emergency podcast already this week, and it's still only Wednesday. It's a packed studio for reasons that will become clear, so let's say some quick hellos to our regulars. Naomi Smith, CEO of Best of Britain, running back and forth from party conferences, basking in the glow of that Supreme Court victory. Hi, Naomi. How are you?
Good. Still here. Still happy about yesterday.
Well, amazingly, there was somebody I met at the live show that said, do we really have to meet at 8 a.m. for this vigil outside the Supreme Court? Why is Naomi doing this to us? And then it rained. And then I saw her on the news at the vigil. Yeah. So she actually went and did it. So it looked very exciting. Were you expecting the verdict to go that way?
It was very hard to read some of the judges last week because they didn't say much. There were about four of them that really were doing poker face and not giving it away. So we were sort of hopeful, but not expecting anywhere close to the unanimous verdict that we got. So, yeah, we're really, really pleased. But it was a bit of a surprise for it to be as good as it was.
On the news, I saw an all-star cast of former Romaniacs guests outside the court. Who were you with when the judgment came through?
I was with the Romaniacs live people. We were there with lots of Best of Britain supporters, stood right up against the railings. I was getting a live readout from inside, and everyone else was following with a delay on their phones. So I was able to say, we've done it, and then the crowd went mad and the cameras were all pointing towards us, and it was really lovely. And then we started our chant of reopen Parliament.
Oh, it was nice really to see Anna Soubry look happy.
Yeah.
She's not
often. She's often there.
Also with us is Roz Taylor, who was on the panel for our late show on Monday. Hello, Roz.
Hello.
There was some sort of pre-verdict nerves on the night. Does it feel like a great weight off our shoulders? And how long before the weight is deposited on our shoulders again?
Yeah, it felt great yesterday, briefly. I mean, it's with Brexit, it's this long kind of despair interspersed with moments of great hope and excitement. And it was like that yesterday, and I kind of had faith in democracy again, and then, oh God, yeah. So, usual run-of-the-mill stuff.
Completing the regulars is Ian Dunt, editor of Politico.co.uk, and a man who spent most of Tuesday tweeting baffled expletives. Hello, Ian.
So every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, no, it's meant to say every day. It's a typo. So everyone's back in Parliament now. So that's exciting for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, quite exciting. Yeah, it was nice. I mean, today has got a weird atmosphere around Parliament. Like, in the morning, there are, like, these roving gangs of men with video cameras and photographs. So they look like they're getting geared up for war. And then slowly, like, the two Leave and Remain armies come along to start screaming shit at each other. So, like, if you leave Parliament and, like, someone, like, screams your name, you're like, oh, God, please let them be the good guys. Please let them be the good guys.
We're talking about dealing with shit. The heavy, heavy, heavy rain yesterday. You know the underpass from Whitehall that goes under Whitehall up to the entrance of Parliament. There's two public toilets down there, and the heavy rain meant that there was literally raw sin. They had to close the whole thing off. And there's the metaphors of Parliament is literally drowning under the weight of its own shit. Literally, rather than just metaphorically, wasn't wasted on us all, and it bloody stank.
This week's special guest is Robert Webb, actor, comedian, author of How Not to Be a Boy, star of shows including That Mitchell and Webb Look, clues in the name, Peep Show, where he played the useless Jeremy, and Back, which will literally be back sometime soon. Hello, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How's Brexit treating you?
Oh, I try. I try. I don't come here with any expertise. I see my role today as, you know, sitting in the corner as a kind of Martin Freeman everyman character. So you look 35 degrees away from the camera and kind of sigh. That's what I mean. I mean, you may hear me occasionally swear or just burst into tears, but really, that's how it's treating me. That's how it's treating me.
Were you happy yesterday at least?
I was happy yesterday. Yeah, no, it was exciting. I'm only just recovering from watching the Jeremy Vine program today, where he said there was some discussion about the Supreme Court verdict, and he was saying, I think, now I've met Jeremy, he's a very nice man, I'm sure he's a very kind man, and there are more important things than being clever. But he said something along the lines of, 11-0, it sounds fishy to me. I mean, because it's very nuanced. So 6-5, that would be more plausible. And I just I thought of
wow.
David Mitchell and I once wrote a radio sitcom for Armstrong and Miller called Children's Hour. And a character called Craig Children, played by Ben, at one point said, it's not black and white. It's not black and white, is it? Some things, I suppose, because you're clever. I suppose everything's grey when you're clever. That's a kind of dumb person's idea of what clever feels like, and that everything should be grey.
I like the idea that also it needs to be, that a Supreme Court verdict needs to be plausible.
Yeah.
Like it's a kind
like
of screenplay.
Like it's made up.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was very much... But I think that, yeah, he was interpreting it as a Brexit thing rather than a legal thing. And, you know, as, I guess in Jeremy's mind, 52 versus 48% is equals nuance. So it should be more nuanced.
Damn you, reality. Your first novel, a time travel romance called Come Again, is out next year.
Mm.
Does the character just travel back to early 2015, make a few key changes...
Oh,
and stay there.
No, that would be far too... That would be a lot of hostages to fortune there, Dorian, because what is the present day? No, I try to avoid politics, although the middle section is set in 1992, which has a kind of, you know, the book is about love and grief and the limits of nostalgia. And, you know, I feel a strange pull to John Major's 7 years because, you know, there was a lot to argue about, but there was this strange hippie adherence to the rule of law. and, you know... 1992, you know, 2 years into that government, another 5 to go. It wasn't a Blair decade at all. It was a Tory decade. So it's a kind of interesting period.
Well, if someone living in 1992 had time traveled to the present day and would just like, wait till you see what John Major's like now. It's amazing. Everybody loves him.
It was amazing. It's kind of amazing because you get people like Major and Ken Clark especially. And you know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember Ken Clark as just one of those faces in a deeply divisive and some would say unnecessarily cruel Thatcher cabinet. And these days, he's fucking Gandhi. It's, you know, has he changed or have we just moved a long way in the wrong direction?
Did anyone see the tweet that resurfaced from the BBC Question Time Twitter this week from 1988? And it was Gordon Brown's first appearance on Question Time. And he was debating Andrew Neil. And Andrew Neil was making like the unashamed case for a federal Europe. And Gordon Brown was being all Eurosceptic. That's how much things have changed.
Gordon Brown was like, steady on.
Yeah, exactly.
Life's a journey. Rob's going to help us through the thickets of the Supreme Court case. like Toby Young, he's become a constitutional scholar in the space of an hour.
If I say we're turning into America because that's the other system I've heard of.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay,
brilliant.
Then that's... I've done it.
That's it. I'm surprised Toby doesn't have one of those special wigs to make him look more judicial. And the fallout from the Labour Party conference after these few reminders from Roz.
Our Democalypse 2019 live shows earlier this week were tremendous fun, and if you're a Patreon backer, you already know where our next Romaniacs live show is taking place. It's a bit of a change of location, and the best way to find out where and get discounted tickets is to sign up to support us on Patreon. Let's face it, the money from Michael Gove's Get Ready for Brexit adverts is going to run out sooner or later, as is the entertainment value. Search Patreon Romaniacs, pledge a small monthly amount, and you'll get every edition of the podcast early, plus first dibs on live tickets. And we'll be getting the weekly column back in gear as soon as possible too. It's all been rather hectic lately, you might have noticed. Find out how you can help the show and get those in-demand Romaniacs mugs, T-shirts and other extras. Search Patreon Romaniacs as soon as you finish Googling GIFs of Lady Hale.
Thanks, Roz. Now for some music. Spider Broach, gave PM a big reproach, ruled his prorogation void, now his Robespierre's annoyed. Look out, it's Spider Broach. So, a big day for Gina Miller, Joanna Cherry and Spider-Woman Lady Hale. The pound leapt after the verdict and MPs raced to be first back in the chamber. The first we spotted, I think, was Tom Tugendhat, tweeting from the benches. He wins a Romaniacs T-shirt. Get in touch with your size and address, Tom. Roz, on our emergency cast yesterday, David Alan Green said this was the most important constitutional ruling in generations and enjoyed saying it. Why is that?
Well, it turned what was basically a convention into a law. and it's said that a prime minister could no longer prorogue parliament without a really good reason. And that has always been taken for granted in the past, but with our mad new world, it's clearly no longer the case. So the Supreme Court said that, no, you can't prorogue parliament without a good reason. Go back and sit down and go and discuss stuff again.
Because Dominic Cummings is an unparalleled genius, he's always eight steps ahead, he briefed that whatever happened, they just prorogue again. How would that pan out? Like, how much, if they really just wanted to, like, front this out, legally, what could they get away with?
That would be difficult because Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, who was speaking in the Commons today, said that he would respect the judgment. However, you can be quite sure that he will be combing very minutely through it for any opportunity to find another really good reason to prorogue Parliament as he sees it. So I don't have an awful lot of faith in that. However, I just think it would be... I don't think it could happen again, but perhaps I'm fooling myself. I think it would be just have too much chutzpah to prorogue Parliament again at this point.
Naomi, the plaintiffs were careful about saying this was about preserving the law, not rolling back Brexit. And indeed, the government was very keen to say it was about the Queen's speech, not pushing through Brexit. But I suspect there's a little bit of Brexit in there.
just teensy-weensy little bit.
Where does the verdict leave Remainers? What options...
It just gives us a little bit more time, which is the key thing. So will they prorogue again? They're going to try to. The lovely Remainian MPs are keeping their cards very, very close to their chests for very obvious reasons, because they cannot afford to let Rees-Mogg find out what they're planning. But they are planning plenty, so be assured that they are working incredibly hard on it. And they're closing all the different loopholes as far as they can to stop the government pulling any tricks. They may let them have a bit of a recess for Tory conference next week to let them just have a little bit of that, but they may not. And they're certainly going to do everything they can to block any second prorogation. But yeah, I mean, there's it's the usual seizing control of the order paper and doing everything that we can now to get this second referendum.
Ian, Corbyn suggested on the Today programme that you might be able to deny the government permission to suspend Parliament even for the Tory conference. Mm. That seems quite ballsy. Do you think that would happen? You can just... Bad news for Manchester's hospitality industry and probably for the Conservative Party.
I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. It's certainly something that they're talking about in a very sort of real way. Because there's no... At this point, you sort of think... And this is also, it's sort of PR, really, because the reality of it is... The legislation that needed to be passed was passed before the prorogation took place, which is, you know, the Benn Act, exactly. Yeah, sorry, it's an act now. Basically saying, look, we're going to take no deal off the table. So once that's done, in terms of what you really, really, really need to do, that's actually done there. And so now there's this quite weird reverse feeling on a lot of Remainers, like, well, we do need to make sure that we're looking busy. Because we have
And there are loads of these QAs that have gone in. What are they called? UQs. Mm. All these unanswered questions. So they've back-to-back them. They're coming up on all sorts of issues that are nothing to do with Brexit. So loads of stuff around Thomas Cook and other issues. And this is a way to send a very clear signal that there is shit that Parliament needs to be doing and talking about. There is very, very, very important stuff that we need to be...
The domestic abuse.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much that... And so they need to send that warning shot. But similarly, the government need to try and put a Queen's speech and justify their whole rationale for prorogation in the first place. So they will move to try and do that. I'd say that the Remain MPs are a little bit split on whether they should allow them to do a bit of a mini Queen speech or not. But yeah, you're exactly right. Like there is stuff for them to be doing and they're going to get on with it.
You know, it's almost like parliaments are useful and some sort of check on the executive in times of, you know, political crisis or otherwise.
Rob, the reading the judgment was very exciting and made an instant star of Lady Hale in one of those kind of weird social media politics moments. But some people have warned about making a hero out of her because you don't want a US-style approach where judges are sort of heroes or villains. It's that kind of like notorious RBG thing they have. Well, that's because, of course, it is much more politicised between the Liberal and the Conservative judges. I mean, do you think there's a danger of that, that it's sort of like the flips as the, say, the right-wing press and the Brexiters are trying to make out that the judges are biased, if we're just like, you go, girl?
Yeah, I mean, definitely you go, girl. I mean, and it wasn't just the brooch, although it was mainly the brooch. Wasn't it? But no, of course, you know, one gets very excited when you see somebody who really knows how to do their job really very, very, very well doing it and explaining to Boris Johnson why he's not allowed to do his job very, very, very badly. So, you know, it's very exciting. And it's almost welcome back experts. The experts have come back for a moment. Mm. And I just had that feeling yesterday. Like, the feeling I got, I mean, you know, it didn't end well, did it? But the feeling I got in May 1997 when Labour were elected, and I just went, actually, I've just spent 18 years growing up in this country thinking this is a mean, nasty country. And actually, it's not like that. It's, you know, there are people who will elect a civilized government who want to do cool things. And so, and it was just a mini version of that. That actually, okay, look, there's the grown-ups, just for a second, just for a moment. It was like a break in the clouds. It's like, it felt like, you know, the frustrating weather of a functioning democracy. It was a moment.
Well, I don't want to be smug because partisanship.
Oh, go on. Look where we are.
You are a Ramona.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no. No, but partisanship can make you do, it's very, very hypocritical and inconsistent. But I really don't think that if the judgment had gone the other way, I would have spent the rest of the day sort of exposing the backgrounds and social habits of the judges.
Well, it's, I mean,
it seems like very much something that they're doing that I don't think we would. I think there's something about Remainers that you're just less likely to try and delegitimise judges.
You see it from time to time. It's funny, but also unbelievably upsetting and irritating when you see, you know, right-wing commentators or Brexiters talking to each other as if across, you know, on Twitter, as if across a crowded room, saying they still don't get it, do they, Julia? No, they don't, Toby. They don't get it. You know, this is a room full of people who apparently don't get it that we lost the referendum. I mean, we really do get it that we lost the referendum. It's just that Remainers were people who looked at that ballot paper and said, but how are you going to do this? And they go, fuck, we don't know fucking how we're going to do it. We're just going to do it. Yeah, but how are you going to do it? We're just doing it. Just get on with it. But how? But, okay, what, Mrs. May's deal? Would you like? No, fuck that. I don't like that. Not like that. Well, how are you? I don't know how. Ow, I've hurt myself. I don't know how. You fucking do it. That's what it's felt like for 3 years. And so, you know, much as, you know, one wants to discriminate between the people who simply voted leave, for whom I feel some, you know, look, we've only got each other. We've got to live with each other eventually. And, you know, you can quietly, they can quietly change their mind. You remember, we were talking about the 90s. You remember those plastic straps that used to come down off the back of cars with that sort of zigzag design? It was a sort of placebo for car sickness. And every other car had one of these things trailing, making contact with the ground. And a lot of people thought, okay, that's cured my... had absolutely nothing to do. I mean, people are still manufacturing this now, so legally, I'm sure those companies, their heart, they do it in good faith. But those quietly just disappeared, and you didn't have to rub their faces, their noses in it, and say, "You idiots! You've wasted £1.29 or whatever it cost in 1988 to put this thing on the back of your car." People can just quietly change their mind, and you don't have to go. You know, it's fine. So, you know, my feelings for the people who led the prime movers of Brexit, Rees-Mogg and Francoise and Johnson and Cameron, you know, my feelings for them are less gentle.
Ian, before Geoffrey Cox made his statement about accepting things, Johnson made a kind of speech in New York with his bezzy mate Donald, who's also had quite the week. Saying that he respected the judiciary, it's the best in the world, but he profoundly disagreed and would carry on regardless, which is, it's just a brilliant way to respond to any ruling that you don't like, saying you just profoundly disagree. Was he, like, when you saw that, did you think that it was a just bluster? Do you think there was any threat of him just somehow going...
No, because actually the judges took that out of his hands. They were basically, I mean, they came to the end and went, there's nothing, we don't need to do shit. They didn't use this language, mildly different. The Prime Minister doesn't need to do shit. it's up to the Speaker of the House of Commons and the Speaker of the House of Lords, and they're going to do it. So there was nothing, he didn't have to comply. In fact, it was more humiliating than that. It wasn't up to him to comply. It was up to Parliament as a sovereign body. What was more, so, you know, what we were seeing there was constitutionally this murky constitutional structure that we have become rigid where it needs to be rigid against actual executive threats to the manner in which our country is run. So that was positive. But then the other murkiness came over, and that was in Boris Johnson's manner. Because look, we've talked about this before, but so much of our political culture and our political system is based on there being a sense of honour to your conduct. And we have seen throughout this process basically the death of shame, that there is no such thing as political shame. And certainly if there is, Boris Johnson doesn't feel it for anything at all. He will lie as easily as he breathes. He will say one thing and then another. And he will do all sorts of behaviour that previously would have been completely out of bounds, as if it had never taken place. Now, in any other situation, you would have expected certainly the Prime Minister to resign over this. If you just look at the statement, the Prime Minister illegally closed down Parliament. If you can read out that statement and go, what should follow from this statement? You think the Prime Minister should fucking resign. And Jacob Rees-Mogg should obviously resign. And so should the Attorney General. He's not going to do that. But not only not that, the crucial cultural thing was he didn't even show any fucking contrition. He didn't even show any sense of apology about the manner in which he'd done things, and he never, ever will.
Well, do you think, to be the Attorney General, can he survive? Will it be Cox out?
I think he'll make it through. Thank you so much for that, Dorian. That was... bring us up to our best possible level.
You can't do that on Brexit cast, I'm telling you.
I think he's going to make it through. I mean, for a while in the Commons today, he put in quite a good show where he was saying, look, you can question the judgment, but don't question the motives of the judges, which is, I think, a fair enough distinction to make. And he was all right then. And then he just fucking switched, man, like he took the potion. And suddenly he just went apeshit and started screaming about how the Parliament had no right to morally sit. It was a dead Parliament. Now, that stuff, that's really fucking pernicious, because that is a Parliament that was elected by the public under legislation that meant that it would have been there until 2022. Mm. So on that basis, for him to say it has no moral right to sit is actually quite abominable, and it signals what the government's intention is, which is to sort of smear the reputation of the Parliament if it's unable to close the Parliament down altogether. So suddenly I went from thinking, actually, I'm fairly sympathetic to the way that you're going about this, just thinking, oh, you're absolute gibbering fucking maniac, and I do wish you'd shut up. Unfortunately, he didn't.
Was that when Barry Shearman went ape on him?
Yeah, which is the angriest shit I have seen in my life in the chamber. I've never... I mean, he starts with, like, one hand in his pocket, the other hand out. And by the end of it, it looked like his mouth was going to, like, tear open his face. And like, he was just screaming. I was like, fucking go on, Barry!
And the way that he said, barrister's bluster, like it was the most filthy phrase in the world. Naomi, we're obviously very happy, but the other side seem to be quite cross about this. Leave EU and the Brexit press are pumping out the sort of narrative of elite, unelected Remainer judges and so on. Obviously, the whole point of the British judiciary is that it's unelected and not identified political parties. How you can see the narrative already, and it's another part of the elites versus the people thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's just going to speak to the base?
Yeah, it's just red meat for their base. Overnight polls from YouGov and Comres show that the public back the Supreme Court, 49% on the YouGov one, 50% on the Comres one, versus 30% not and 29% not. And Farage has started doing lots of Facebook ads in the last 24 hours now, which are sort of general election focused, and it's all this sort of people versus Parliament rhetoric, and he's targeting them at his core, because now Facebook publish everything, you can see who their audiences are, and he's just going after the base. They're not persuading anybody new with this.
And fundamentally, it's about the big papers backing Johnson in this, because the Mail is still behind him, the Sun is still behind him, the Telegraph, the Times to a certain extent, because it's so freaking excited by the prospect of a no-deal Brexit, like all the other papers, that it just can't resist that having that, you know, excitement there. It's them that is keeping Johnson in post. If they turned against him, he would almost certainly go.
Well, David Alan Green spent the most of the day, when he wasn't doing the podcast, correcting people who should know better, including Tim Shipman, who I usually respect, sort of about the role of the courts, and because Tim Shipman's going, well, obviously now we have to go to an American-style politicised Supreme Court. And it was like, hang on, particularly since that's not how the American Supreme Court started out. It's like, we don't need to immediately go to Trump-era Supreme Court politics. Do you think that people... he's obviously an intelligent man, but then there's less intelligent people on the internet. Do you think people just, a lot of people just don't understand how the judiciary works? Even that phrase, unelected judges, just sort of betrays some sort of crucial lack of understanding of the role.
Yeah, I know that they don't. And why should they? A lot of them have not been told about how judges and how the three branches work in school. I certainly wasn't. I don't know if anybody else. I was born in, 1975? And I have no... they never mentioned judges or government or anything like that. It was... And now there is a citizenship curriculum, so maybe there is some of that going on, but most of it is optional, so I doubt it. Why should people know, particularly when they're, the press as well is so horrifically bad at explaining it? I don't blame people at that level at all. And it's also really confusing for people, because you've got to remember, this case was brought by private individuals. Mm. And so naturally, Brexiters say, oh, you know, who is funding them? How can they interfere in our democracy in this way? Well, the only way that this case would have happened is by private individuals funding it, because there's no other way to...
On that, Best for Britain gave Gina Miller £40,000 towards her legal fees, and that was crowdfunded. That was all from our People's Parliament Fund, and that was thousands of individual donations. So this, you know, as you say, it was private individuals, but lots of small, tiny donations supporting that, because they felt so strongly about it.
Let's end by returning to shame, absence of, and the Akuri scandal. Akuri. So if another prime minister had given a model/entrepreneur £120,000 of public money and visited her Shoreditch flat in the mid-afternoon, and she'd lied about her address and her application, it would be sort of serious news. Why? Do you think this story is going to sort of grow?
Yeah, I think it is.
And get picked up? I mean, it is news, but it doesn't seem to be picked up in as many places as I thought. Maybe it isn't hurting him, but maybe... Is this a shame issue? Is this another question of, like, you front it out and it's not a thing?
I don't get that. I mean, I think it's been on the front of the Mail a few times. I mean, it's been covered, I think, quite heavily on the Beeb. It's being raised in Parliament at the moment. There was the first day...
That's raised in Parliament, yeah.
Yeah, it's been discussed today in Parliament by a friend of the show, Leila Moran, who raised it against the DCMS. And obviously it's been taken up in the London Assembly. I think in the first couple of days there's a bit of wariness, as there often is, because there's a lot in newsrooms, there's a lot of chatter around the love life in previous years of the Prime Minister, and there's lots of legal nerves around that. Mm. And I think probably on the first day, some of the reticence maybe from the BBC was, let's just make sure everything's sort of over here. But I mean, certainly at the moment I see quite a lot of coverage of it.
And he's got 14 days, well, less than now, 12 days or so before the GLA. So this isn't going away anytime soon.
No, and journos, I mean, the lobby. Like, the lobby has lots of things against them, but when the lobby smell blood, they will fucking, they're going to come for you. Mm. And like, he did a lobby briefing where six times he just refused to comment on it, like refused to deny all of this. And so like, you couldn't, you know, if you come in with buckets full of blood, like a final scene of Carrie or something, just showered them everywhere. Like, you know, they would have just been like, no, I think there might be a story here, actually.
It's also
they're gunning for him.
It's like, it's not only his lack of shame, but it's kind of shame fatigue on our part. And actually, you know, I mean, what can you do next that will be surprising? I mean,
exactly. It's like straight out of the Bannon playbook, though, isn't it? It's about demonstrating your virility and your manliness, and you're having all these affairs with these much younger, more attractive women. He'll probably just be told to front this out, and it'll just help him with his core base in the way Trump sex life does with his.
This week's podcast comes with very welcome support from The New Yorker, home of the very best writing in the world today. We're big fans of The New Yorker. While so many other places seem to be going shorter and shallower with their hot takes, The New Yorker and rankings, so many rankings. The New Yorker trusts its writers to go deep and spend a lot of time on a story. They bring you the best and most enjoyable picture of politics, the arts, international news, science, plus all the fascinating stuff that takes place in New York, if you happen to be passing through New York. Romaniacs listeners can get 12 weeks of The New Yorker plus a New Yorker tote bag to show off how cosmopolitan you are for just $6 by going to newyorker.com/romaniacs, and it works in the UK and Europe too. Choose digital and print or just digital, and you get full access to world-class reading from what's new in The New Yorker to their vast and brilliant archive, to the cartoons, the crossword puzzle and more. And there's 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories online every week too. And we're going to talk about two of them. So start with, like, leading on, I think, from your mention of Trump, Naomi. Trump, Yeah, I Did It, So What, by John Cassidy, where he says, to the ruthless go the spoils. If you have enough gall and shamelessness, you can get away with almost anything. And what did you make of that?
I mean, I liked how it drew on the fact that we shouldn't be surprised that he behaves the way he does. You know, historically, he's flouted all sorts of laws, dismantled it. I think they used the example really brilliantly of Trump Tower and how he demolished this beautiful Art Deco building to put up this ghastly thing. And at the time, initially, there was all this hoo-ha about it, but he was right to just front it out because everyone just forgets everything and moves on with their lives, and you know, no repercussions for somebody doing that. So yeah, I thought it was really interesting.
I do like that. I thought it was very New Yorkish in the way that it starts with this example that you might not know, and it's in 1979, which is very New Yorker, and you're just like, what? That was ages ago.
Oh, I get it.
You know, whereas kind of like a lot of these kind of like web opinion pieces, it really is like the first line. It just has to be like, this is what this is about.
Yeah,
I kind of like that. Even on the web writing, there's a sense of taking your time. Then there was The Brexit Agonies of David Cameron by Rebecca Mead, which had the brilliantly dry line about what he's up to now. He goes, he runs, plays tennis, brackets, not with Boris Johnson.
The idea of Boris Johnson playing tennis at all is horrifying. I mean, just imagine the galumphing, sweaty... I mean, I don't mean to be sizist, but, I mean, I just hate the guy, so why not? And, ugh.
This is not a quote from the piece. This is Rob's freestyling here.
I'm reading it now.
Do you think there is some benefit, Roz, in seeing Brexit sort of explained from abroad to readers who are just not constantly in the weeds of it?
Yeah, totally, because you've got no sense of perspective or distance anymore. Here you get it. You get it's partly it speaks to what Naomi was saying earlier about you just getting gradually acclimatized to someone's appalling behavior and not starting to ignore it and starting to take it for granted. And the more distance you can get and from the morass we find ourselves in. It's like, I mean, Brexit at the moment, it's like trying to navigate your way across a bog. It's just, you keep getting sucked in by one thing or another, and then the whole landscape changes, and it's just like, oh, God. And actually moving away from it and having some perspective and seeing it as other people might see it is incredibly valuable.
So that's 12 weeks of the best writing on the planet for just $6, plus a very nice tote bag too, when you go to newyorker.com/romaniacs and use the code romaniacs. That's 50% off the New Yorker's usual offer to get the self-care your Brexit-battered brain needs. newyorker.com/romaniacs with the code romaniacs. Should we talk about the Labour conference for a bit?
No.
There was, I remember, some exasperation at an apparent stitch-up when Momentum Unite and the rest of the loyalists packed the floor to ensure backing for Corbyn's constructive neutrality policy on Brexit on a show of hands. Roz, was that a good look for a party that was meant to be an optimistic movement driven by member democracy?
No, it was a bloody awful look. It was a terrible conference. It was a complete shit show. However, they were very lucky.
How could something that starts with a failed attempt to remove the deputy leader by literally erasing the post be bad?
You ask an interesting question there, Doreen.
It was like a real, like it was like it was fake John Hinckley. Because Tom Watson said it was like Lee Harvey Oswald. It was like, no, it's John Hinckley. Didn't work.
No, it was awful. I mean, the fact that there wasn't much scrutiny of Labour conference really acted in Corbyn's favour because everyone's eyes were on the Supreme Court yesterday, and they were very lucky that they didn't have more journalists there being savage about it. Having said that, they managed to get a Labour policy in front of people, which abolishing private schools, and that cut through and people talked about it, and that is what a lot of people remember. So maybe that counts as a minor success.
Also, the conference voted for freedom of movement, to protect freedom of movement this morning.
This morning, I moved because I knew they cancelled it yesterday. I hadn't seen it.
Yeah. I don't know how much weight
hardly
that
anyone
has.
Noticed.
I mean, I went to the conference twice. So I was there, then I had to come back Supreme Court, and then I went back again.
Was it very Moorish?
It was very boorish. it felt like there were two parties sharing the same venue for their conference. So there were two Brexit motions. There were meant to be two climate change motions because the unions couldn't agree on the 2030 deadline. So both were due to go down. They both got pulled. And yes, and then the immigration motion committing them to free movement went through on the last day, which I wonder if that sort of lines them up for Norway. Mm. And a resurgence of the Kinnock position on things.
Well, Kinnock's old position.
Oh, yeah.
He mutated into true, what a garbled true. Version of himself he is now.
No comment. But it did not feel like a party conference for a party that was, you know, imminently seizing the reins of government. Definitely didn't have that vibe to it at all. Very, very, very flat. And there's certainly a sense amongst the lefty, pro-European block of MPs that Corbynism now needs to continue without Corbyn, and that they need to make much more space for a pro-Remain lefty to come through the ranks. And yeah, and then the Tom Watson thing was really interesting, the sort of the Landsman failure to get that through. Clearly, Landsman worrying about Corbyn going and the heir apparent not being yet successfully lined up enough to become the leader. But apparently what was going to happen, and maybe Ian knows more about this than I do, but if they'd managed it and they only didn't because one person turned up late to the vote, and otherwise Landsman would have got it through, you would have had Watson walk away with about 30, 40, maybe more MPs, maybe even 70 MPs, to sort of like an independent Labour grouping, which would have then laid the foundations for a GNU in a much more serious way, and then it would have almost been like a challenge to the rest of the Labour MPs.
Government of National Unity.
That's right, yes. Two. Yes, sorry.
It sounds better. It sounds like a posh dessert.
yeah, so I don't know whether to sort of be like frustrated or relieved that it didn't go through, actually, because we may have been in quite a different political environment if it had.
Rob, the vibe that I got from the reporting was a lot of people saw this as a we like Jeremy vote. Is that kind of the fundamental problem with Labour on many issues, that everything becomes a confidence vote in the leader?
I've kind of retired from criticising the Labour leadership. I mean, there are a lot of people that might buy my excellent first novel. it just feels like, you know, 2015, Miliband screwed everything up. Most of the Labour membership went into some kind of fetal position from which they are only just recovering, really, and just because he's had a very lucky time. He's a very lucky leader. I mean, for the, you know, as we were hearing, you know, the Supreme Court thing means that that Tom Watson didn't do a speech, which would have been, I mean, however it went, if they'd cheered, then that would be, oh dear, terrible division. If they'd booed, terrible division. You know, it was good like that. I mean, there's never been, under our stupid first-past-the-post system, there has never been a Labour majority led by someone from the left of the party. Even if you had someone who was very hardworking and bright and charismatic and not 70, it would still be a very, very tough ask. With Jeremy Corbyn, I just can't see it. I mean, they can't see it. I mean, they know. That's why they're talking about his succession already.
Do you think that there is a successor from that wing of the party that would kind of
Richard Burgeon, fix things? Prime Minister Rebecca Long Bailey? Not really.
Laura Pidcock.
Maybe.
Another one.
Everyone they get really excited about. You're just like, really?
Yeah, I mean, you look. I'm constantly
come
looking.
On, she's a woman who is a loyal Corbynite. It's like, I'm not saying that, you know, she could grow into a really impressive politician, but it's like they go, future leader.
Have we had Ben Clive Lewis on the Romaniacs?
Oh, I don't think so.
They don't like Clive Lewis anymore, do they?
Because he started to sound sensible.
Yeah, so he's quite independent-minded. Mm.
He might be worth getting on the show, though.
Oh, no, I like it. I like Clive Lewis a lot. I just don't feel like he's in their kind of future leader zone.
I found the whole week so weird. They're just so, so weird. Because even, like, I don't even object to the Corbyn leadership's position on the Remains. I kind of get why staying neutral makes a sort of sense. I certainly don't feel passionate about it either way. But when you just look at the debate of just like person after person getting up and all they talk about is just support the leader, support the leader. No talk about the actual fucking content of the thing. Mm. You just look at it and you know, do you remember there was that thing of like, not, you know, not a cult, that you'd get quite a lot of sort of backlash for calling it a cult? And you're just like, what other word do you expect me to use for the fucking spectacle of this shit? So after a while, you're just like, even when you don't particularly disagree with them, they just come, it comes across like such a pernicious kind of almost millennialist fucking thing. Just seems like such a poisonous atmosphere.
Well, their main criticism of Tom Watson is it's just disloyalty. Tom Watson has done a hell of a lot to keep non-Corbyn Labour supporters sort of on board, but you know, with messages on anti-Semitism, on Europe. When people left to join the independent group, it was Tom Watson who was basically, I got the impression, was really just going, no, to other people, don't leave. But, oh, because he's not loyal enough to Jeremy. There's just something very sort of like pathetic.
But it always felt like that's the way that it was going to go, because in 2015, you know, when he turned up, those of us who'd heard of him thought of Corbyn, thought this is a bad idea, because they're going to spend a lot of time trying to change the Labour Party and absolutely no time trying to get elected to change Britain. and that's sort of what's happened. He's not interested in persuading people who don't already agree with him, and neither are most of his most vocal supporters, so I despair.
Their Brexit position, polling showing that it's not clear. Understandably, Brexit Party and the Lib Dems are the ones that people feel they have clarity of what the position is, but even Labour Party members being polled say that the Lib Dem, they understand the Lib Dem position much more clearly than they do. The Labour position, good luck selling that on the doorsteps. You know,
but even if you like the Labour position, it's not clear.
No, exactly.
It's too complicated.
It may be, you know, credible and just, but it is going to be a hard sell if you're a canvasser.
I don't think it is that complicated. I find myself weirdly defensive towards it.
Compared to the others, it is.
How often do you canvas people?
Because they're going to go and negotiate.
I hate meeting humans, and I try never to talk to them, unless they're in this room. However, I don't think it's impossible to just go, like, we're going to try and get a deal, and then we're going to offer you a vote on the deal. I don't think the complication isn't the problem. The problem is that they're not on one side or another when everyone is. Mm-hmm. And I get that. I see that there's an electoral problem there. But... The complication thing, I do think people are smart enough to comprehend that.
Well, I think what is true is that what unites them is if there is a referendum on a Conservative deal, they back Remain. That is the one thing that they are now totally united on. So what we need to push those Labour MPs into is that second referendum and get more of the Labour waiver MPs, particularly in the north of England, over onto that, because they're the final hurdle to get the numbers to get it through. Because that is one thing that the Labour Party is united on. It falls down when it's post a general election.
That freedom movement thing also, by the way, if they stick to that freedom of movement motion that they've now passed, and they won't necessarily. I mean, other things have been passed. The private school thing that was passed on the floor of conference sounded very different to the shit that Jeremy Corbyn was saying this morning on the Today programme, where it was like, oh, we're going to take away VAT status. And it was like, that's not what they were talking about. They were talking about pretty much just taking that shit over. Yeah, it's like executing the headmasters. they went a bit further on that conference. But if they do stick to it in the negotiation for the deal, if you've gotten rid of the freedom movement problem, if you're now officially going to stick to it, then just go into the single market. Exactly. Yeah. You're completely done. So you would.
But never say never.
Fine, it's normal.
We've given it the conference a mixed review. But do you think it...
Have we?
But do you think it sort of ended well? Because I was in absolute kind of raging despair over the kind of like the weekend and Monday. And then the Supreme Court verdict happens. Johnson's on the ropes. Suddenly, Corbyn's speech seems pretty good. His Today programme interview, pretty good. Mm-hmm. It was like, did it end well because he can only do well when all the attention is on Johnson's problems?
I think there's something to... That's certainly true for the final speech he did at the conference, probably. And also, you know, it's quite a pathological sort of party. So they can want to murder each other one second and then they're all in some great big group loving the next. And that will happen maybe anyway. But the Today programme interview, I thought, was like genuinely interesting
good.
This morning.
Yeah, it was
he
good.
Comes across... And it's not the first time I've heard him. But I remember he was a bit like that during the general election. Do you remember the interview with Paxman where... You know, Theresa May wouldn't debate him face to face, so it was them one after another. He has this sort of persona that suddenly comes over when he doesn't look like he just wants to kill every single member of the media.
It's great when he's talking about someone else. And also, you know, he is genial and likable sometimes. And I think it helped that it wasn't Humphreys, and Humphreys is gone. And so he's not at it. But, the interview with Maher, it's back to this kind of very... petulant, very defensive, very, I want to talk about the media the whole time, I want to talk about how the BBC, you know, all that stuff, which surely nobody likes. But when he's talking about something he's passionate about, he's a very talented campaigner. I've never, you know, I'd never disagree with that, which is probably why it's a good idea that he, if there isn't a second referendum, he stays neutral, because no one's going to believe him if he goes around saying that I'm interested in Remain. It's better. Mm. I think the Remain campaign would want him out of the way, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Win-win. Support for this week's podcast comes from Stitch Fix, the personalised online styling service that makes shopping for clothes quick, easy and painless. Fixing your wardrobe for the busy autumn protesting season is, of course, a nightmare. Who's got the time to spend all day in changing rooms when you could be doing a Brexitometer on the high street or listening to anti-Brexit podcasts with your family, which they love? Stitch Fix has the solution, and it's really simple. You just fill in a quick online quiz on your favourite looks, preferences and body shape. Then your own stylist, an actual human being, will put together a collection of new clothes chosen just for you from a huge selection of top brands. Stitch Fix deliver your selection straight to your door with free shipping and free returns. You keep what you want and return the rest. You just pay a £10 styling charge, and even that comes off the price of anything you buy. Find out more. Sign up today at stitchfix.co.uk/remain. In, you filled in the form and got sent some clothes.
What this is true. All of those things happened.
In your box of delights.
Yeah, it was good. I kept 3 out of 5
That's
items.
That's good.
They were the exact opposite of the items I thought I was going to take.
What did you keep?
Look, I'm going to say this out loud. It is a pair of purple chinos.
Oh my god!
It turns out
you are the guy.
And I never fucking dreamed that that's quite could be possible. But it is. Yeah. So, and I did tick that thing when, you know, push me a bit, but don't push me too much.
Yeah.
I wish I could manage all human relationships in the same checkbox. Yeah. By the way, yeah, 60% push me a bit. Like, that would be great.
I think that'd be great just in conversation, wouldn't it? Just like push me out of my comfort zone a little bit, but not too much.
For each evening. Yeah. You could like allocate that would
be tonight I'm feeling comfort zone only.
Yeah. Only 10% push me out of my comfort zone. So I did that and I kept like there was another sort of short sleeve shirt, there's another long sleeve shirt. Quite liked it. Someone said a nice thing about the long sleeve shirt when I went out.
I like the way it makes me think about clothes and clothes choices in a way that I find a bit overwhelming in shops.
You do.
I'm really bad in clothes shops.
You've said this multiple times.
I get scared.
The only thing you get is checkered shirts. So I love that.
I'm not mentioning my failure of imagination this time. I'm just mentioning my anxiety in shops. I mean, shop anxiety is exactly what this is designed to fix. So take the stress and effort out of clothes shopping and discover new brands that might become your favourites. Get started today by going to stitchfix.co.uk/remain. That's stitchfix.co.uk/remain. Our special guest this week is Robert Webb of Mitchell & Webb, Peep Show, Back, and being a Brexit obsessive on Twitter. one of my favourite presences on Twitter is your fellow Back cast member, Jeff McGiven.
Oh, yes.
Who is a guns-blazing Remainer, but lovely with it.
Yeah.
Is it one of those... is Brexit kind of a big conversation topic on set?
Oh, blimey. Well, we haven't made it for a couple of years now. So Jeff is actually obsessed with AI. Not the movie, but the oncoming storm of technology. He's really worried about AI. It made me want to read I've never said this word out loud.
Chivers, yeah.
Chivers, not Chivers. Okay. It made me want to read his excellent-looking book. I'm sure he'll be delighted to hear. no, we didn't. So when was it? It was 2017. So, yeah, I mean, we were talking about it a bit, but no, it doesn't come. I mean, the thing about a filming day is everyone got up at 5 and the actors are either worried about their lines or bored or both, and because you know the bit in between action and cut is like 10-15% of the day and the rest of it is watching David Mitchell do a crossword I should get a better hobby really. But there's
your own crossword.
There's a certain amount of chit chat but it doesn't I think sort of high adrenaline stuff about that takes up unnecessary energy about like for example politics doesn't come up that often. I did a pilot for the BBC once with Peter Egan, who used to play the smarmy next door neighbour in Ever Decreasing Circles, Paul. There was a wonderful moment where Richard Brier says to him, he can't get his car started, and Richard Brier says, "Why don't you give it one of your smiles?" And anyway, but Peter Egan was both a massive Brexiter and a massive Corbyn fan, and wanted to talk to me animatedly about both before a take. And I'm kind of I'm really feeling a little bit... Sorry, darling. We're men of the left. We take things to heart, don't we? I'm sorry. All right, darling. Yes, we're men of the left. Can you shut up now, Peter? On-set conversations tend to be low-bent.
Presumably, you saw the Twitter game that's going around about how various sitcom characters were devoted. Obviously, there were some various different peep show versions.
That went on forever.
But there were lots of... And they got quite obscure. I was like, I don't even know what the show is. But and also, there were multiple peep show versions, because one take is that Mark would vote leave, because he likes war and discipline. And Jez would be a vibey liberal remainer. But then Mark is also very sensible and status quo-y. And Jez seems unlikely to ever vote. So can you give decisive judgments on these?
No, I can't. I can give you an opinion. I do not write Peep Show. I did not write Peep Show. But my take would be, I mean, I changed my mind quite often. I changed my mind about how Peep Show characters would vote for Brexit.
Jeremy would forget.
As often as I changed my mind about Brexit. Jeremy probably didn't vote.
I agree.
But if Jeremy voted, it was certainly Leave, because he wants to shake some shit up.
Yes.
And that was his whole, it's sending a message to Westminster, kind of, yeah.
Fight. Same as Superman.
He would interpret that as the punk vote. Mark certainly voted Remain.
Yeah.
Because he's a cautious fellow.
Would Superhands be one of those, like, those former communists, like Alaric Bamping?
Superhands just drew a cock and balls on the ballot paper. Yeah.
I thought that, or a Brexit Party MEP. So.
Yeah, because they all kind of dress like you would imagine Superhands to dress if he had to turn up in court.
You grew up in Lincolnshire, which is...
home of Brexit.
It's very Brexit. Yeah. Brexit. Other things as well. You and Brexit.
Sausage.
Tennyson, Margaret Thatcher, Brexit. And now me.
And now you. So it's kind of like, it's batting kind of 50-50.
Yeah.
Do you still have family around there? Are there kind of exciting conversations?
I do, when it comes to Lincolnshire, I'm for them, I'm of them, but I don't necessarily know anything about them anymore. I mean, I grew up there, I spent 20 years there. I was born in Boston, which is the most heavily voting town. But I mean, I've got two older brothers who still live there. I think they were both Remainers. I know one was. I choose to believe the other one. But he's getting quite annoyed with the EU. There's some cut through there that he thinks the EU are being intransigent, and he's starting to change his mind. He's going the wrong way, but I don't know what he'll do. I've got a couple of school friends and my English teacher, but they're all Remainers, really. And my brother works with farmers. His job is he buys potatoes and other veg from the farmers, and he sells them to supermarkets. And he was saying all the farmers were Leave, and he was at the time perturbed by that and kind of thinking, this is not a good idea for you guys. But I find myself quite torn about it, really, because look, I wanted to be an actor, so I moved to where the work was. I moved to London, and I walked down the street and, you know, London's famous Soho or West Hampstead, where I live, and I hear lots of different accents, lots of different voices, and it doesn't bother me because I chose to live in a world city. There are people in Boston who didn't make that choice and who
people who speak other languages.
This is the thing.
Boston.
The Lincolnshire had.
Yeah, because there's so much agriculture and so seasonal workers coming in. So there's a lot of Polish people around, and the people who chose not to leave or weren't in a position to leave, they're not quite so comfortable about that. And I can't tell them how they should feel about it. I can call them names, but I don't think it would really help. But, you know, they're just people who they don't want to live in a world city. They want to live in Boston. They want it to stay pretty much the same as it always was. And I have some sympathy for that.
Well, on our live show this week, James O'Brien, his sort of sympathetic reading was, there's a lot of people, it wasn't just we want Brexit, as we want to matter once, we want to affect things in some way or another. And that is why so many of them, I think, are sort of clinging to that season. It's like, this is the time that we were heard and we won, because, of course, in first past the post, a lot of the time people feel their vote doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Do you think, does that ring true? That...
Yeah, I mean, there's a Lincolnshire is tremendously isolated. I mean, it's a huge county, but it's nobody lives there, and it's well, not many people live there, and it's, you know, from where the village I grew up, you have to drive for an hour before you get to the first dual carriageway, which is the A1. I mean, it's which also known as the Lincolnshire bypass. I mean, it is very isolated. But what I remember growing up in what was a working class stroke lower middle class. I mean, we read the Daily Mirror. And we drove secondhand cars and we watched Only Fools and Horses. And we didn't mind. In fact, you'd be watching the weather and so there'd be the national weather map and they'd have highlighted Lincoln. And you'd go, Lincoln. And it was like, okay. It's like we were famous that night. But the rest of the time, we didn't really care that we were so completely ignored. And it doesn't really have that much of a... Unlike a proper northern city like Manchester or Liverpool or you know the West Country or Scotland, it doesn't really have a massive sense of itself really. It's so nebulous really. I mean, we didn't really care that we were totally ignored until I guess you know again it's this thing of the referendum coming straight off the back of austerity. And so you're being asked, is there anything that slightly fucks you off at the moment? Please vote for me. And, you know, that was what was really dumb about it. And you go around towns like Skegness, which, you know, as far as I was concerned, when I was 7, was literally the best place in the world. you know, I've been back since a couple of times for filming reasons. And it really is very run down and no one looks very healthy. And, you know, it's tough there. And I can imagine why they're kicking off. It's just that none of it is to do with the EU.
One of the clips that I notice is always popping up, often in relation to many politics stories, particularly Brexit stories, is the Mitchell and Webb look sketch with the Nazis ask, are we the baddies?
Mm-hmm.
Was that one of those, sort of in the world of GIFs, that is your yours and David's lasting contribution?
It was written before GIFs existed.
But, I mean, was that one of those ones where you think, like a hit single, where you just go, this is the what? When GIFs are invented, this will... No, but do you know what I mean? We just go, this is a brilliant resonant point. Has it sort of surprised you how, like, it sort of has a life of its own?
I'm much more arrogant than that. I'm just disappointed it's our only famous sketch. But it's... yeah, I mean, it's great that people still really like it. I think we knew we were onto something. I mean, I can't remember whose idea it is, so therefore I'll claim it's mine. But the way we used to write sketches, we'd go to the pub... and come away with 5 or 6 ideas and then write them up the next afternoon. So we clearly did because it's sketch 1, episode 1 of series 1 of that series. So we clearly had some confidence in it. Otherwise, it would be sketch 14, episode 5.
Those are the ones to look out for, are they? Yeah. Just like, not that one.
If the sketch 2/3 of the way through episode 5 is as good as anything... No. It's that would be the least strong sketch. So as long as that was as good as contemporaries that we did not admire, what they would put in episode 1, then we thought we were doing a good job.
But does that sort of speak to the political climate at the moment, where you cannot believe that your political opponents don't realise that they're bastards?
Yeah.
Just like, come on, man. You're trying to, like, tear down Parliament and the judiciary. You're kind of racist. You don't give a shit. How can you not know that you are the baddies?
Yeah, I'm really sorry that that it was so prophetic in that respect, because you do just sense two tribes just staring at each other and just baffled incomprehension and loathing. And that's why, you know, I wish we could end this podcast with a plea for tolerance, like all good episodes of Star Trek. but yeah, oh dear.
I do hope that in the GIF, just people who only consume culture through GIFs don't think that David Mitchell is actually a Nazi.
Yeah, no, that would be a shame because he's not really. I can exclusively reveal.
Bill. Not a Nazi. Good to know.
It's official.
Your book, How Not to Be a Boy, looks at the miseries of masculinity in the form of a memoir. Brexit does seem to be full of angry, damaged men. Do you feel like there's a kind of, there is a sort of toxic masculinity to a lot of, I mean, I've got a picture of Aaron Banks in my mind at the moment, but do you think there is, you know, when you kind of like psychoanalyze Brexit?
I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist and I shouldn't really...
You're not a psychiatrist. Dave's not a Nazi.
We've got a whole list of things we're not.
Not, yeah.
But I mean, sometimes it's not so much masculinity that reminds me of it. It reminds me of addiction. It looks like people who have discovered some... they sense some void that they have to fill with external things. And they all never get, in this case, despising foreigners. And they will never, I'm talking about the ERG types and the, you know, and the Rees-Moggs, and that they'll just never, they'll never be enough. And I mean, it's not even a proper death cult. I mean, with, you know, with say heavy drinkers, heavy smokers, they think the risk is an early death. Whereas in fact, in their more serious moments, we realize it's not, the risk is not early death. The risk is 10 years in a wheelchair followed by early death. Mm-hmm. And it's like Brexiters haven't noticed that, you know, Britain's going to spend a decade and a half not being able to wipe its own arse. And that's the risk, is the all of the anguish and humiliation and resentment and guilt and hopelessness that comes with that. Not death's fine. Death doesn't hurt. Death, you don't feel it. That's what they... I just feel like... And it's partly, you know, you say masculinity and there's all this martial language about, you know, surrender and the EU are the Nazis. And it feels like to them the bombs have been falling in their heads for years, and they live in this... one of the safest, richest, freest countries in the world, and it's not easy doing all three at once. And yet they find it intolerable because... they have to deal with these foreigners in some way.
When you look at the stuff that's going viral around Thomas Cook, it's not any of the horror stuff about the thousands and thousands of people that lose their jobs in the supply chains and the people stranded. It's the feel-good stories about the whip-around that they had for the elderly couple who now can't go on their cruise. And it's that blitz spirit, but we'll be all right no matter how awful the shock. We'll all be all right together.
I've got some time for the idea that some of this is baby boomer guilt, that they are the sons and daughters of soldiers, and they haven't done the same.
Yeah.
And now can we have a bit of that? Because I'm sure we'd have done it quite well, really.
Fetishizing.
It's the kind of the machismo behind No Deal, which is just like, why are you scared of No Deal? Are you weak?
Mm. Yeah, but again, it's not No Deal, because as I'm sure has been said many times, as I know it's been said many times because I'm a fan on this show, is that it's not No Deal. It's not a clean break. It's a rolling crisis for years and years and years. That's not what they're gearing up for. They're gearing up for that's it. There'll be a cataclysm and we'll be fine. No, there'll be an ongoing dreary decline. I mean, even with a deal, there will be a serious decline over the next 10, 15 years, and that's why it was a really bad idea.
It's just shit war, isn't it?
It's shit.
Like, I'm not going to be able to buy the stuff I like in the supermarket. It's not even a good war. I mean, if you want to go through it, then actually call to declare war on China. That would be a good war. Short, but you know,
but decisive.
I'm not going to name this writer. But he was around during World War II. And,
who could it be?
I can't imagine.
No,
actually. Like, it's
could
really
be
hard.
Could anyone. Could be one of many. Yeah. Anyway, he in his war diaries, he's basically, and his war letters that he wrote. He was a journalist. Right. He was a writer. Yeah, uh-huh. It was a man. Yeah, moustache. And anyway, he said that. He said, the thing is, he goes, it's not the fear of a bomb landing on you. It's not the fear of death. It's just like the grinding irritation and tedium of the Blitz, of just not being able to get proper fags and not being able to get kind of, new shoes and having to like queue for stuff and just like everything being kind of gritty and grimy. And I think that's it. A lot of people sort of remember the Blitz just like, whoa, like very dramatic, because generally that's the kind of cultural memory, but not the kind of like the actual just... low-level sort of stone-in-your-shoe irritation of it.
Mm. I like your book about 1984 very much. Well, I'd say that with everyone listening.
OK, it was George Orwell. Before we go, if you like Romaniacs, you'll enjoy our new companion podcast, On the House, with Tory refugees turned freedom-loving Lib Dem MPs Sam Gyimah and Philip Lee. Now that the Commons is sitting again, they can return to the original plan of talking politics over a pint after Parliament. Actual Parliament. Thanks, Supreme Court. There's a new episode every Friday to make sure you subscribe to On the House on your favourite podcast app. From the current episode, here's Telegraph Westminster editor Owen Bennett bowling Sam and Philip a tough one.
The second word in the title is Democrats, right? So surely you guys should stand down and trigger by-elections and say to the people who voted you in as Conservatives, do you want me as a Lib Dem?
Well, there's a general election coming very soon. One. Two. In my case, the reason why I am where I am is because Boris Johnson withdrew the whip. And I was not a member of the Conservative Party. I want to be a member of a party, and he can't blame me for choosing a party that I think represents my values. So he triggered it. He triggered the situation himself.
The elephant in the room is Brexit. It needs to be sorted out. The public want it sorted out one way or the other. I don't think precipitating by-elections is where we are. We need to get on with it as the Parliament, in Parliament, when we're allowed to. Then people will have a say, and that's the way it should be, I think.
We're at the end of the show, which means the Brexit time capsule, container of everything we will need or miss if we ever leave the EU. Rob Webb, you get to choose. What's going in there?
A C-grade or above at GCSE citizenship. I had to look that up. I thought there might be a GCSE civics. Obviously, they have to give it a name that's difficult to pronounce and slightly weirdly emotive. But yes, it covers the same area, you know, finding out who is actually in charge in a parliamentary democracy. The clue's in the name. I think everyone doing that for 2 years would leave us all in a better place, because we will have to make friends eventually.
Education, education, education. This week's foreign language clip is in German from listener Tom Phillis in San Francisco.
Kein guter Start, Boris.
That means not a good start, Boris. Let's have your foreign language clips, record them on your phone and send them to info@romaniacs.com, and we'll use the best ones. And that's the show. Thank you, Naomi. Are you back on the chain gang?
I don't even know what day of the week it is most of the time, so God knows. Yeah, not going to Tory Party Conference, although Best for Britain will be there.
Ian?
I'm not going to fucking go to the Tory Party Conference either.
Ross, will you be going to Tory Party Conference?
I'd love to. I love party conferences, but nobody has invited me and I can't afford the fee. Sorry.
No.
You like them?
Yeah, I love them.
God, they're so dreadful.
No, but I love them.
It's like someone with like a bit of sandwich in the corner
of their
mouth
them.
At 2 in the morning. Talking to them like a fucking hotel bar. And just like, oh, please just shut up.
No, I can't lie. I just love them. Sorry.
Well, there might not even be one. So who knows? Thanks for coming in, Rob. For you, a plug opportunity. What
okay. Have you got?
Plug. No, when's your novel out?
You may know me from such novels as I've written a grief-stricken time-traveling rom-com with jokes. It's a genre book, and it's called Come Again, and it'll be out next spring. It's not available to pre-order, but it's very funny and very good.
Things will be better next spring, I'm sure.
I think it's an act of faith that I'm publishing a book at all.
You're assuming there'll be enough paper.
I'm assuming there'll be a civilization.
It's time for our theme tune by the legendary corner shop. It's called Demon is a Monster. You can get a free download of it at ampleplay.co.uk. Why not do that as we thank our latest Patreon backers?
Hello, and thanks from me to Victoria Berryman, Graham Smith, Thomas Maxwell, Bob Bright, Olivia Fox, Timothy Knapman, Dizier, Darren Vitarana, Rob Kay, Emily Walton, and Ian Dolben.
Thanks from me to Darren Dodd, Helena Stephen, Anne Tonks, P. Mulligan, Tom, Catherine Walker, Andrew, Catherine Braun, Kevin Tobin, and Stephen.
Hello, and thanks from me to Peter Chain, Mark Etherington, Luis Garrido, Steve Hillier, Stuart Lee, not that Stuart Lee, Gary Uren, Debbie Jukes, Christopher Finch, Richard Taylor, and Gareth Close.
And thanks from me to James Walker, Dan Lawson, William, Tom Kirkham, Tammy Lake, Dapper Cyborg, the best kind, Paul, Nikki Bond, Alexander, and David Gardner.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Naomi Smith, Roz Taylor and Ian Dunt. The producer is Andrew Harrison. Audio production was by me, Sophie Black. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.